during secret testimony before a congressional committee, one of Ridgway's closest aides, General James M. Gavin, later spelled out precisely what the Army required: 151,000 nuclear weapons. According to Gavin, the Army needed 106,000 for use on the battlefield and an additional 25,000 for air defense. The remaining 20,000 could be shared with America's allies. At Los Alamos and Sandia, a crash program had been launched to make hydrogen bombs long before it was clear that the Teller-Ulam design would even work. A six-day week became routine, and the labs were often busy on Sundays as well. The goal was to produce a handful of H-bombs that the Air Force could use if Western Europe were suddenly invaded. Unlike the fission bombs being manufactured at factories across the United States, these emergency capability weapons would be assembled by hand at Sandia and then stored nearby at Site Able. Their components weren't required to undergo the same field testing as those used in the stockpile's other bombs. While Teller and Ulam wrestled with the theoretical issues of how to sustain thermonuclear fusion, the engineers at Sandia faced a more practical question. How do you deliver a hydrogen bomb without destroying the aircraft that carried it to the target? The latest calculations suggested that an H-bomb would weigh as much as 40,000 pounds, and the only American bomber large enough to transport one to the Soviet Union, the B-36, was too slow to escape the blast. The Air Force investigated the possibility of turning the new medium-range B-47 jet bomber into a pilotless drone. The B-47 would be fitted with a hydrogen bomb and carried to the Soviet Union by a B-36 mothership. Codenamed Project Brass Ring, the plan was hampered by the cost and complexity of devising a guidance system for the drone. Harold Agnew, a young physicist at Los Alamos, came up with a simpler idea. Agnew was an independent, iconoclastic thinker from Colorado who'd been present at some of the key moments in the nuclear age. As a graduate student at the University of Chicago, he'd helped Enrico Fermi create the first man-made nuclear chain reaction in 1942. Agnew subsequently worked on the Manhattan Project, flew as a scientific observer over Hiroshima when Little Boy was dropped, snuck his own movie camera onto the plane, and shot the only footage of the mushroom cloud. He'd helped to construct Mike and watched it detonate from a ship 30 miles away, amazed to see the island disappear. The heat from the blast kept growing stronger and stronger, as though it might never end. While thinking about how to deliver an H-bomb safely, Agnew remembered seeing footage of Nazi tanks being dropped from airplanes by parachute. He contacted a friend at the Air Force and said, "We've got to find out how they did that." The Air Force had already taken an interest in those parachutes. Theodore W. Nacke, their inventor, had been brought to the United States after the Second World War as part of a top-secret effort to recruit Nazi aerospace and rocket scientists. The program, known as Project Paperclip, had been run by Curtis LeMay, who later explained its aims: rescue those able and intelligent Jerrys from behind the barbed wire and get them going in our various military projects and feed them into American industry. Theodore Nacke now worked for the U.S. Navy at an air base in El Centro, California. Agnew promptly flew to California, met with Nacke, and asked, hypothetically, if he could design a parachute strong enough to bear the weight of something that weighed 40,000 pounds. "Oh, yes," Nacke replied. "No problem." Inspired by the German designs, Project Caucasian, a collaboration between the Air Force and Sandia, developed a three-parachute system that would slow the descent of a hydrogen bomb and give an American bomber enough time to get away from it. The bomb would be dropped by a B-36 at an altitude of about 40,000 feet. A small pilot chute would open immediately, followed by a slightly larger extraction chute. The first two chutes would protect the bomb from being jerked too violently, and then the third chute would open, an enormous ribbon parachute, Teodor Nacka's invention, with narrow gaps in the fabric that let air pass through it and prevented the whole thing from being torn apart. The hydrogen bomb would float gently downward for about 2 minutes, just a tiny little speck in the sky, and then it would explode, roughly a mile and a half above the ground. Bob Purifoy led the team at Sandia that designed the arming, fusing, and firing mechanisms for the emergency capability weapons. Radar fuses promised to be the most accurate means of detonating the bombs, but pinpoint accuracy wasn't essential for a weapon expected to have a yield of about 10 megatons. Klaus Fuchs had most likely given the Soviet Union information about the Archies and other radar fuses used on atomic bombs, raising concern that the Soviets could somehow jam those radars and turn America's H-bombs into duds. A barometric switch or a mechanical timer seemed a more reliable way to trigger the X-unit, fire the detonators, and set off a thermonuclear explosion. Each of those fuses, however, had potential disadvantages. If a mechanical timer was used and the main parachute failed, the bomb would plummet to the ground and smash to pieces before the timer ran out. But if a barometric switch was used and the main parachute failed, the bomb would fall to the designated altitude too fast and explode prematurely, destroying the B-36 before it had a chance to escape. Purifoy asked the Air Force to consider the risks of the two fuses and then make a choice. One fuse might fail to detonate the bomb. The other might kill the crew. When the Air Force couldn't decide, Purifoy ordered that both fuses be added to the firing mechanism. The decision could be made before the bomb was loaded on the plane, with or without the crew's knowledge. Sandia was no longer a small offshoot of Los Alamos. It now had more than 4,000 employees, state-of-the-art buildings with blast walls for work on high explosives, and a year-round test site in the California desert. Plans were underway to open another division in Livermore, California, where the Atomic Energy Commission had recently established a new weapons laboratory to compete with Los Alamos. The University of California managed the labs at Livermore and Los Alamos, but Sandia was a non-profit corporation operated by AT&T. The mix of public and private management, of academic inquiry and industrial production, helped to form a unique insular culture at Sandia, rigorous, grounded, and pragmatic, eager to push the boundaries of technology, yet skeptical of wild and abstract schemes.